Al Scott entered politics in 1976 and has been a power broker, both locally and around the state of Georgia, ever since. The outgoing chairman of the Chatham Commission is this week's difference maker and recounts his rise from a poverty-stricken corner of Savannah to the Georgia Capitol to the most influential post in local government as Chatham Commission chair. And he'll tell us what might be next for him. Difference Makers is presented by the Savannah Economic Development Authority. Digital team at SavannahNow.com, this is Difference Makers, a podcast featuring interviews with Savannah's community leaders about what they do, how they do it, and why. I'm Adam Van Brimmer, and joining me for this episode is the chairman, Al Scott. He is in his final days leading the Chatham County government and closing another chapter in his storied political career, which includes service in the Georgia House of Representatives, the Georgia Senate, as Georgia's Commissioner of Labor, and as the chairman of the Chatham Commission. I apologize in advance for butchering a few dates in this interview. For example, Jimmy Carter was elected governor of Georgia in 1970 and not 1972. Sometimes a lip and the brain just don't line up correctly. Anyway, here's the interview with Al Scott. Joined on the latest episode of Difference Makers by somebody that in this town probably... if there is such a thing as the ultimate difference maker in this town over the last 40 years, 30 years, it's Al Scott, who, as we sit here today on Tuesday, December the 22nd, is wrapping up his term as the Chatham County Chairman of the Chatham County Commission, and has had a long, long storied political career at the state level, at the local level, ran for tax commissioner in the last election, and we're going to find out what he has in mind for the future, if anything. But before we get into that, let's go back. Let's go back, Mr. Chairman, and talk about, I guess, first of all, growing up here and then getting an interest in politics.
Well, you know, I was actually born in Effingham County, and we moved here when I was 5 years old, and grew up in the lanes and the slums of Savannah. And I remember living in 39th Lane right off of Florence Street. And things were a little different back then. We were certainly probably as poor as you can get. And we were certainly in poverty. But we didn't talk about it, didn't think about it, and we didn't approach our lives as if we were in poverty. But the community is so different now. I can remember just walking out of 39th Lane to Florence Street, turning right, walking two blocks, and there was one of the most prominent physicians in the city living right on the corner of 38th and Florence. And then I could go a block in the other direction as one of the most wealthiest black folk in Savannah, and Mr. Mays, who owned a great deal of downtown historic Savannah back in the day. So when then you had a mixture of people who were perhaps on the lower economic end of the scale, living in the lanes, and then you had some of the wealthiest people just living a block away on the street. And I always say you had a lot of role models to choose from back in those days. You didn't have to focus on your circumstances in the lane.
That, of course, is a day of Jim Crow, segregation. What you kind of lived through that transition, came into politics.
Oh, yeah.
Immediately following that transition. What was that like to be in such formative years during such a turbulent time in this country, in this town?
Oh, it was something else. It was a totally different period. But then you can almost see things right now that you can say, well, a lot of things have changed, but there's a lot of things that remain the same in this city. And I can remember leaving the Lanes and moving over in a row house on Montgomery Street across from Christ Buick, which is now the Salvation Army.
Right.
And while I was living in 39th Lane, we had segregated cabs. So there was a driver, Milton Cab, who lived next door to me in that row house, and he drove cabs at night and did carpenter work during the day. And my mother convinced him to make me a shoe shine box. So I used to leave that 39th Lane and walk to a confectionery about a block and a half away and shine shoes on Thursday evenings, Friday evenings, Saturdays. And when we moved on Montgomery Street, I used to walk over to Christ Buick and shine the shoes of the sales folk over there. And so you've seen all that, and everything was segregated. Of course, I went to a segregated school. I went to Beach High. And, of course, I left Beach High at the time when all the schools were beginning to be integrated. That was in 66.
Right.
And when you mentioned about when I started thinking about politics, I had a lot of time to reflect on folk. My mother, for a number of years, did domestic work. And so I was aware of just the haves and the have-nots. And one of the things, since about age six, I've had a job, either shining shoes or working at a fish market or working at a liquor store. Always doing something. And you watch the transition, and we talk about police brutality. It existed then. It was nothing for a white policeman to use an N-word if he stopped you or saw you or wanted you to do anything. He would use the N-word in response to you. If it wasn't the N-word, it was boy. And so that was commonplace. The real difference now in poverty-stricken areas, they were not the weapons that you currently have. There were fights and cuttings and stabbings, but it wasn't as many guns on the street as you have today. So it was a little bit different. But I think, people talk about the greatest generation. and of course, the World War II crowd may have been the greatest generation, but I think the generation that's really made a contribution is that generation following the greatest generation. The greatest generation did a lot in terms of fighting wars and securing freedom and for the country and all that. But then a lot of gains were made during the following generations. You asked when I got interested in politics. I enrolled in college after high school and didn't go the fall year, and as a result I got drafted. Ended up going in the military, and I spent a lot of time in the middle of the night sitting in foxholes along the DMZ in Korea, mm-hmm. Thinking a lot about our political leaders and why were we there and all of that. And I became an avid consumer of news and politics from that day on. And so that's really when I got interested in it. Now, I like a lot of folk, you have a lot of daydreams. I can remember sitting in high school classes and daydreaming about running for Congress someday. I really didn't get really serious about it until after I came back from the Army and was looking for some place to purchase a house. And I specifically decided to purchase a house in a transitional neighborhood with the express purpose of one day running for political office. And so I moved over in the Baldwin Park area. Mm-hmm. And that's where I really launched my political career, was a run for the Georgia House of Representatives, back then the 123rd District.
Was there anything, any issues in particular that kind of drove you in those early days?
everything. And it, everything from civil rights to crime to taxation to redlining to gerrymandering to insurance, you name it. And insurance companies used to base your insurance rates on your zip code because they denied it. And I resented having to pay more insurance than someone who lived just a few blocks from me because they were in a different zip code. And so I ran for the legislature. I was in my 20s, and like a lot of people in their 20s, I was going to change the world.
Sure.
And that was my beginning to changing the world, was running for the legislature. So I took on a lot of issues in the early days. I took on the issues of the insurance industry, based on rates, based on zip codes. I took that on. That was a major issue of mine. Of course, the lobbyists and the insurance company, they came out of the woodwork, claimed that they didn't gerrymander, that didn't do it. And I said, well, if you don't base it on zip codes, then why are you so opposed to the legislation preventing you from basing it on zip codes? So I took that on as an issue. I took property taxes on is an issue. What's now known as the Stephen Day bill, when I first introduced it, I called it the Truth in Taxation, that required local government, if they wanted to increase taxes, they would have to do it through a millage rate because the taxes, although your property value went up, your taxes would roll back to the previous year. It failed, and later it was taken back up and eventually passed in a different format. But I took on all the current issues. I can remember when we did a rewrite of the Constitution to try to take out all the racial languages that was in the Constitution at the time. We didn't get it all, but we got most of it. And so it was the first major rewrite of the Constitution. So when I was in the legislature, we took on a host of issues. I was on the Ways and Means Committee, so I certainly took on a lot of tax issues. And in addition to serving on the Ways and Means, I was on reapportionment. I can remember getting on reapportionment, asking the speaker specifically to put me on reapportionment, and he said, I don't understand why you want to be on that committee, son. I said, it doesn't do anything but once every 10 years. He said, and I tell you, if I put you on it, I'm not going to ever take you off of it. That's what he said to me. And I wanted to be there on it because I knew it was important in drawing the lines.
Right.
And so I served on the House Reapportionment Committee and actually reapportioned not just the legislative districts after the 1980 census. Mm-hmm. I also, for the first time, put the city of Savannah into districts. Prior to that, they all ran at large.
Okay.
And I can remember that there were no blacks on city council, and it was the bartering and bargaining of the NAACP that got the first black on city council, which was Bowles C. Ford. Mm-hmm. And then 4 years later, we bargained and was successful in getting the second black on city council, which was Roy L. Jackson. And so I felt that you had to trade everything that you had to get representation on city council, that we'd be better off if we had districts.
Right.
So initially, I drew up 8 districts for city council. And what I discovered, and I didn't check anybody's address or where they lived or the zip codes or anything else. I just drew districts of equal size, the city of Savannah in the 8 districts. And I found out later that I ended up putting Roy Jackson and Bowles Ford in the same district. One lived in Cloverdale.
Right.
One lived in Bel Air, which is, they were probably 4 blocks from each other.
Right.
And then on the other side, I ended up putting Nippy Morrison and Leo Center in the same district. Mm-hmm. And so I later went to Justice Department and asked them to approve the 6-2 plan that you currently have. And the reason we have those 2 at-large seats, one was to save the Jewish incumbent mm-hmm. and a black incumbent.
Right.
Really, it was intended, those two at large seat, to save Bose Ford and Leo Center on city council.
Yeah.
And so not only that, I went on to reapportion the county commission, the school boards, mm-hmm. and outside of adjustment for population, those districts remained pretty much intact as I drew them in 1982.
Reapportionment's, it's an interesting topic, and the legislature's going to go through it again next year, and I want to talk to you about that. We'll come back to that. But so you go into the Georgia House in 74. It's a very interesting time in Georgia politics, correct?
No, I didn't go in 74. I actually ended up going in 76.
In 76.
Yes.
So that's the year that Jimmy Carter is elected president. Am I correct in that? Yes.
That's correct.
Yeah, so that's a big year for Georgia politics, right?
Yeah.
What was the climate like?
There was a lot of excitement about Carter running for president, but I was surprised at the resentment of him.
Mm.
And Carter served in the state Senate mm-hmm. prior to running for governor. And back then you had term limits on governor. You could only run one term.
Mm-hmm.
So he ran for governor, was term limited. And so he immediately started running, mounted a campaign for the president of the United States. And, of course, he was from what referred to as peanut country, a farmer, but mm-hmm. he was also a Navy officer and someone who had a master's degree in nuclear physics. So I thought he was an extremely smart guy and had a memory like nobody's been this, because I can remember seeing him after he lost that election in 1980 mm-hmm. To Reagan, and he set up headquarters in a hotel downtown while they were building the Jimmy Carter Library and that center out there. And I used to run into him in the airport and in the lobby of that hotel that I stayed at, and he would always say to me, and this was after I'd moved from the House to the Senate, and he would always say, "How are things in the Senate, Senator?" And I was in the Senate when we invited him back to hang his portrait
right.
In the Senate.
Right.
But I ended up moving to the Senate after the 1980 census, and we drew new lines. We also drew new lines for the House and the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had, for the first time, a Senate that was possibly could be won by an African American. Mm-hmm. And it was drawn really for Bobby Hill, but Bobby elected to stay in the House. He wanted to protect his seniority. He had like 14 years of seniority. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to give it up.
Right.
Where if you were like me, if you were just sitting there for 6, 7 years, 8 years, you didn't have much. And so I decided to run for the state Senate at that point.
Right. Listening to the Difference Makers podcast and a discussion with outgoing Chatham Commission Chairman Al Scott. Before we continue, let's pause and recognize the Difference Makers presenting sponsor and a real difference maker in our community, the Savannah Economic Development Authority. The team at CETA is pushing to make Savannah a great place to work and live. CETA is committed to creating, growing, and attracting jobs and investment in the Savannah region. Whether a business looking to relocate to the Savannah area, or an existing business ready to grow and expand, CETA is the centrifuge of a propeller, making the connections, helping propel the business to success. Learn more about the Savannah Economic Development Authority and what they do in the Savannah community by visiting CETA.org. Now, back to the interview with Al Scott. Today, the Chatham County delegation is Republicans and there's Democrats. They at least, on the surface, seem to work pretty well together. They pull together in order to further initiatives for Savannah. Was it like that back then? How has that changed? Is it less collaborative now or more?
Well, I hate to say this, but when I was there, we had one of the strongest delegations in the state,
mm-hmm.
bar none. And we had differences, even if it was racial differences or anything else, with our delegation. We worked it out in meetings.
Mm-hmm.
It was never up front and center in any debates. Now, when it came to statewide legislation,
Gotta go your
everybody
own way.
Went their yeah. went their separate ways. But I served during a period where the Democrats were more conservative than the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had Herb Jones, who was a Republican member of our delegation. Mm-hmm. Our delegation was chaired by Arthur Genlett, who went on to be president of Savannah Electric and on the board of Georgia Power.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur and I remain good friends today. He was active in my race for chairman. And he's up in age, but we had a very strong delegation at the time, and so it was easy for us to get things done. And so we had a very good working relationship. And then in the Senate, we had one of the most influential senators because he was very wealthy, in the person of Jack Rowley,
mm-hmm.
who was in the Senate, who represented that. First district senator, which is now represented by Ben Watson.
Right. Right.
And of course, I was in the second Senate district, which is the Senate that's represented now by Lester Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And so Arthur was the long serving chair of the delegation. He later retired. And then I actually became chair of the delegation mm-hmm. when Arthur and Triplett left. And that left me at that point as the senior member of the delegation. So as a member of the Senate, I chaired the Chatham County delegation.
After all that time at the state capitol, did you miss it? Did you miss it when you were gone, or were you ready to move on?
No, I left, but I really didn't leave, because when I left the Senate, it was voluntary. And I went over to take over the Department of Labor, so I was the state labor commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
So I really didn't leave the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
I was just in a different capacity. I was no longer making laws. I was no longer debating stuff on the floor. But I was over there during the session two or three days a week, especially during the budget part, although the Department of Labor's budget is 99% federally funded, very little state fund. But I was over there quite a bit. You always had issues that that members of the legislature wanted you to address. I used to say back then that they really wanted the Department of Labor as an employment agency.
Right.
I can remember when I was labor commissioner, the Speaker of the House daughter worked for me. So,
mm-hmm. Oh,
so,
boy.
So you had a mixed bag back then. So. I really didn't leave. So when I left the Department of Labor, when I lost my bid for re-election, I was I missed it for a little bit, but I didn't I didn't share any tears over it. I always, when I left, I said, you know what, this office really isn't worth running for, and to this day I believe that the labor commissioner should be appointed.
Yeah. So you come back home, you do other things. Politics bug was still in there, though, right?
Actually, I stayed out of political office for 18 years.
Right.
And during that 18 years, I served on the state school board mm-hmm. for a short period of time. Mm-hmm. And I would have served longer, but I just couldn't take it. And so I went to the governor and asked him to please appoint somebody else. And he found a replacement for me in the person of Virginia Edwards at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's Virginia Edward Maynard now, and she was retiring superintendent of the Chatham County Public School, and he put her on the Board of Education for the state, and that was terrific for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then later I got appointed to the Georgia Ports Authority.
Right.
So during that 18 years, I had a stint on the Department of Education Board, and then I also served on the Port Authority.
And you're also very active behind the scenes, right? You were still involved with NAACP.
I'm still involved in the Democratic Party. And at one point, I was chair of the local Democratic Committee.
Mm-hmm. What could you do maybe behind the scenes that you couldn't do out front and vice versa in terms of influence?
Well, I people will accuse me of this, but I also almost treat my being in office the same as being out of office. I still do a lot of things behind the scenes, but you could get a lot of things done. you could influence a lot of folk, and especially if you've got some clout. I became very good friends with W.W. Law, and at one point served on the executive committee before he left as the president. I was friends with Curtis V. Cooper, who succeeded Mr. Law. Those are the two longest serving presidents of the branch. And at one point, I chaired the industry and labor committee for the NAACP and helped integrate the UPS, who had just moved into Georgia. And at that time, they had no black drivers, no black employees of any kind that I know of. And W.W. Law and I worked to make certain that minority drivers was hired at UPS.
Mentoring under people like W.W. Law, who are legendary in this town, when you think back on their time, their legacy, and what maybe you contributed to that, what comes to mind? What resonates with you?
You know, W.W. Law wasn't so much political. Gene Gaston was the one that was very political. Gene could no longer participate in politics once he got appointed to the bench. And, of course, no one remembers this, but Gene was also a workman comp judge for a short period of time that he was appointed under Carter. And then not only that, back during Shelby Myers' days, Gene was assistant county attorney. And Gene was very close with the mayor. He was always cutting deals. So I kept a watchful eye on some of the things that he was doing before he became Superior Court judge. And then he and I were not very close until after I was in office. In fact, he didn't even support me for the first time I ran. And that wasn't a surprise to me. But he and I later became good friends, and we spent a lot of time talking about politics. And then I served on a number of boards with Curtis when he was president of the NAACP, and he and I talked a lot of politics. Curtis was probably more political than W.W. W.W. was more community-driven, wanted things for the entire community by any means necessary, be it politics or otherwise.
Right. You know, you think about the NAACP and what they've done in this town over the last 50 or 60 years, it's pretty mind-boggling, right? I mean, it's incredible influence.
Well, I would say that at least 50% of everything that's been accomplished in the black community is a direct result of the NAACP. Mm-hmm. And you can go back to the 50s and move forward.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about your time on the county commission, but before that, you mentioned Georgia Ports Authority. You were on the board there. That's something in your lifetime that has gone from a little bit of nothing to now one of the busiest in the country.
That's something in my lifetime that I launched.
Yeah.
From nothing.
Right.
To what it is today.
Right. Talk about that.
I actually and most people don't know this story, but Curtis Forts, who's associated with the real initial growth spurt, although Doug Marchand was the senior person out there in terms of management. When I was on the board, we saw a need for a chief operating officer, and the chief executive officer at that time took exception to that. And we insisted that we create the position. The board went out on a limb, created the position of chief operating officer. And since the chief executive officer was opposed to it, we decided that we wouldn't let him handle the search, that we would do the search ourselves. And so I chaired the search committee to hire Curtis Forts to the port. So that was the first chief operating officer that the port ever had. And I was vice chair at the time of the Port Authority, and we hired Curtis. The other thing I did, and the port did not track containers beyond their gate. They collect a fee on every container that crossed that dock. And that's how they generate revenue. And so they were not really connected to the rest of it. And I had the Port Authority when I was chair to commission a study to determine where each container that crossed that dock, what was their final zip code destination.
Right.
And I wanted to know that because I wanted to go up and brief the members of Congress on the impact of the port in their congressional district. And I can assure you they had no idea. And we were back then in the early stages of arguing for money to deepen the harbor.
For the deepening, yeah.
And so we wanted them to understand the impact of the port in their congressional district. And because then the executive director had the job impact study done. And then when Curtis came on, we wanted to look at fully utilizing the existing facility we had. He brought in some great ideas and did a lot of things to expand it and really to expand the existing footprint. Mm-hmm. And then the port across the river that we're currently talking about building at some point, we actually got to start the early stage of discussion about that when I was chair. Mm-hmm. We had clandestine meetings with members of the South Carolina. It would be myself as chair, and the vice chair would meet with their chair and vice chair of the South Carolina Port Authority to talk about the potential of that port downriver. Mm-hmm. We used to meet over in Hilton Head to have those discussions. And we would never assemble with a quorum to get around the fact that we would have to have an open meeting if we did. Mm-hmm. But we started talking about building that port at some future date. But the real thing is that we had no long-term planning going on at the port. So the Port Authority board at that time insisted on a five-year long-term plan for growth at the port. And they hired a consultant and developed the first five-year plan, and they fell in love with it. And then they went from a five-year to a 10-year plan. And they were slow to embrace change, but once they did, they really got on board and drove it. So I consider the fact that I lit the initial spark that led to the real bonfire out there at the port with the growth when I was chair.
And the interesting thing is, we're not talking that long ago. Right?
Not that long ago, no.
15, 20 years?
Well,
late 90s?
You're talking in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're talking in the 90s and early 2000. Right. And because I served during Bond's years in the first term of Sonny Perdue.
Right.
So, no.
it's just exploded.
You're not talking that long ago.
It's just exploded out there.
And because every governor, though, since George Busby, was a big supporter of the port. Mm-hmm. Busby was a big supporter. He opened up the first office in Asia. Mm-hmm. Not only that, Zell Miller was a big supporter. Mm-hmm. He got Home Depot warehouse and Kmart warehouse at the time, and later Walmart mm-hmm. warehouse. So every governor has been a big supporter of that port since George Busby.
Is that state embrace of it and basically the it's run so it's they run such a tight ship out there that people talk about how that has kind of allowed them to catapult past some other ones just because the state is
well,
so
you know, important. When I was there, we were competing with South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And we would exchange from year to year which, whether it's South Carolina or Georgia, would get the most containers. And it was really after we brought on a chief operating officer and that position was to focus purely mm-hmm. on the growth of the port. Mm-hmm. And that freed Doug Marchand up for a lot of travel and solicitation.
Right.
And we had someone there who was focusing on growing the existing mm-hmm. facilities. So that team worked well and really, really launched it. And I also think that they also discovered instead of spending all your time in Asia looking at the shipping lines, talking to shipping executives, that perhaps you need to go to Benton, Arkansas, or some of these other places where domestic shippers were bringing stuff through the port. And in the final analysis, the owner of the freight is really going to determine where it ultimately lands.
Mm-hmm.
If not, he will he or she will make other arrangements.
Yeah, so woo them and yeah. the business will come. Again, you are listening to a conversation with outgoing Chatham Commission Chairman Al Scott on the Difference Makers podcast. While the chairman takes a short break, I have a call to action for you. Subscribe to SavannahNow.com. More and more lately, I'm told by podcast listeners and casual newspaper readers, Adam, I like what you guys are doing over there. How do I support you? The answer is simple. Subscribe to SavannahNow.com. And if you're already a subscriber, do business with our advertisers. We aren't public radio. We're not a nonprofit journalism outfit. We offer great journalism, and we charge you for the ability to consume it. Go to SavannahNow.com or download our app and see our product for yourself. Then hit the subscribe button to get full access for just a pittance. Now back to the Difference Makers interview with Chairman Al Scott. Let's fast forward toward running for local government. I know before we hit the microphones that you originally approached not about the post that you ran for, but for something else. What was your path to get back into politics in a frontline capacity?
A conversation with a friend of mine about running for mayor, and I rejected that idea. And I said that if I ever got back into politics on a local level, the only office I'd run for is chairman, because that's the only office that really has any authority. And so we were talking about it, and then Pete LaCactus was chair at the time, and Pete was trying to get a third term. And I committed that if Pete was not successful in getting his third term, that I was going to run for chair. Had he got his third term, I probably never would have ran for chair. But he didn't get his third term, and I ran. And I don't talk about it much, but I tell folk that I'm the first black who've ever served as chair, and the county has been around since 1777.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people talk about first, but I think if you're the first at something, the true sign of your success, if somebody is able to be the second.
Be the second, that's right.
And if they're not able to be the second, then that means you didn't do a good job as being the first.
What were some of your priorities? And as you look back now, almost 8 years, did you get done what you wanted to get done?
I don't think that you're in an elected office if you get everything done that you wanted to get done. You had low expectations in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came on board with just brimming with things I wanted to get done. And one of the things I wanted was a long-range plan for the county. I just believe in planning.
Right.
And I think it's part of the key to success in whatever you do. And so I insisted that the county embrace planning. And the county is a different governmental entity. I really don't think that the masses of people really understand the county government. And I can't say that I've done a great deal to enlighten them. But the county have very little discretionary funds. We are the fiscal agent for all the constitutional offices. When I say constitutional offices, it just simply means their position is written into the Constitution. There's nothing you can do about it. They get elected based because you have a sheriff position in the Constitution, yeah. a tax commissioner. And so,
District attorney, public attorney.
We are the fiscal agent for the court system, the DA's office, the sheriff's office, the tax commissioner's office, voter registration, board of elections.
Mm-hmm.
You go right on down the line. Every judge at the courthouse, we're their fiscal agent, with the exception of recorder's court, which the city of Savannah is the fiscal agent. Everything else is there. The county commission, the deeds are in the name of the commissioners, the courthouse, or any other property. And so you have very little discretionary money. And what I found in politics, that you have everybody wanting to spend what's discretionary money they can get their hands on pet projects.
Right.
It doesn't always have the benefit for the good of the entire county or state. So I decided that we needed a blueprint, or we needed a strategic plan or something to direct us on where we need to spend the money based on input from the taxpayers as to what they would like to see their discretionary dollars spent on. And so we developed the Chatham County Blueprint. We go back every year and update it based on a survey of the voters in the unincorporated area, mm-hmm. and try to keep it current. And so let that be the driver of discretionary dollars versus nine people, the chairman and eight members of the commission,
horse trade.
Yeah. With pet projects mm-hmm. and small dollar amounts. In the end of the day, a year from now, you haven't accomplished anything with the taxpayers' money. So I'm proud to put that in place. When I came on board, we were paying a starting wage for people who work in public works of $8.72 an hour. That's above minimum wage, but you can't attract or maintain anybody. So I raised that to $12 starting. And my intent was to try to get it to maybe $13 or $14. The current living wage in Chatham County, I believe, is $12.90. Mm-hmm. And so you have to start people at least with a living wage in order to retain them. If not, they'll work for you as long as they have to until they can find something paying 50 cents more and they're leaving. And I convinced the management team that by the time you cycle folk and train them, that
you've invested.
You're spending the $14 or $15 an hour. You're just not paying it to them.
Right.
And so I think that was a big accomplishment. And the other thing is that I was always opposed to longevity pay. And I was opposed to it at the port. And we implemented what I call pay for performance. Mm-hmm. And so all managers are supposed to sit down with their employees, do an evaluation on, and make that the determination of what wage they would get for the year. And so we put that program in place. And those are some of the changes that I think will go on long after I'm gone. And then, of course, when I came on, the biggest thing I had, we were under construction with the new expansion of the jail.
Right.
And we did that with lost dollars you can't use for operations, so we made no plans on how you would staff that jail or where the funds would come from. So I came on with a big argument with then Sheriff St. Lawrence about the staffing level for the jail and how it would be funded. And so I also at that point said, well, we shouldn't build another splosh project unless we know the impact on the taxpayers. So we implemented a program to do a study of each splosh project to talk about the impact on the taxpayers once that project is built, what it will cost to operate it, what it will cost to maintain it, what it will cost to staff it. So you won't bill yourself into a tax increase. And so now the cities are beginning to adopt that approach. That's something that will be going on long after I'm gone. And so those are the kind of structural changes that I've made to the county that I think will long live. But since I've been there, you know, we were also under construction with the new health department of Allen Eisenhower. We completed that. We completed the jail project. We remodeled the clinic down on Drayton Street of the Chatham County Health Department. We renovated the interior of the courthouse on Montgomery. It used to be Montgomery. It is now the J. Tom Coleman Courthouse.
Right.
I renamed it when I came on board, and there's a story why I wanted to rename it, and people may not remember it, but for those of you who are old enough to remember, Tom Coleman was chair of the Chatham County Commission, and he built that courthouse, and he went to the voters with a bond referendum to build a courthouse, and the voters turned it down. It was like a 55-45 vote for no. And Tom built the courthouse anyway, using urban renewal funds and any other funds he could get his hands on. And he said to me, I said, Tom, what were you thinking when you decided to build the courthouse after the voters turned down the bond referendum? He said, they really didn't reject the courthouse. They rejected how it would be paid for. And he said they didn't want to put their property taxes up for collateral,
right,
for the bonds. That's what I got out of it. That's what he said to me. Mm-hmm. And so he said, I went and looked for other funds to build it. So I thought that took a great deal of political courage to pull that off, right, and to explain it the way he did. And so I thought anybody with that kind of courage to build that courthouse, it ought to be named after him.
Right.
And so when I came on board, and Tom and I developed a very good working relationship when I was in the Senate, and so I decided to name it the J. Tom Coleman Courthouse in honor of the late Tom Coleman, who I thought was a terrific statesman and a tremendous politician in this county.
That's an interesting take, because I think a lot of people will look at you and your leadership style as a little bit different, too. How would you describe, I use the word people maybe a little heavy-handed. How would you describe your leadership style, and why has it worked for you?
Well, I do a lot of homework, and I do a lot of behind-the-scene work, a lot more than most people can ever imagine. I never come to a meeting and I don't know the answer to any questions, or I try to anticipate the answer to any questions that might be asked by a member of the commission. So I have to spend a great deal of time of studying and thinking about the agenda. And I also, in the final analysis, I said to be successful, I need to stay away from pet projects. So since I've been chair, I've not advanced or promoted any project that I personally would like to see built or anything else. So I call it the taxpayer's agenda. Anything that goes forward, whether a member of the commission voted up or down, they're not voting it up or down against me because it's not my project or issue in the first place. It's an issue that I think is in the best interest of the taxpayers. That's my take on it. If I think we should do it, and I think it's good for the taxpayers or good for the community, whether it's good for the city of Savannah or good for Chatham County, then I advance it. And so I don't take any of it personal.
Right.
And so I think that's the key to success. If you got stuff that you're in love with, and you're trying to advance it, I think that makes you not as effective, because you have to compromise too many things to get your pet projects done.
Yeah, that's makes sense.
Yeah.
As you leave and you look ahead to down the road here, what are some of the things in this community that you think need to be addressed in the next 20 years, whether it's affordable housing, whether it's crime, whether it's transportation networks? If you had a magic wand for the day, what do you think would be the biggest impact of things you could fix if you were given the ability to snap your finger and fix it?
I think there are a couple of things, and people who think otherwise are really not realistic, and they don't understand the economy, and they don't understand what drives stuff. I think that they ought to be, at least for public workers, there ought to be a minimum wage of $15. I think that there ought to be, and I started a program of trying to get the managers, because that's really the people who are supposed to be running stuff behind the scenes. I started monthly meetings with them, with the county manager, city manager, and all the city managers from all the municipalities meeting on a monthly basis. Mm-hmm. And now they meet quarterly. Initially, they were meeting monthly to try to improve communications. I think that needs to go on. And I think there need to be less barriers, be it city limits, be it that of Pooler, be it that of Savannah, and really think about what's in the best interest of all the taxpayers. I also think that we have too many municipalities.
I was going to say consolidation is the next question then, right?
I think we have too many municipalities. I was a proponent of keeping the police merged. And, of course, some folk with the newspaper and everything else questioned my motives, since I had such a quick response to the mayor's letter to say that he wanted to disband the department. But I'd been in series of discussion with the mayor, and so his action really didn't catch me on surprise, so I was not at a loss for words when I got his letter. But I also wanted to stress to him that I thought he was making a big mistake, and that a merged department was in the best interest of the city of Savannah. It was not necessarily in the best interest of the unincorporated area, but we had to think of what was in the best interest of all, since the city of Savannah is about 50% of the population in the county. And I tried to point that out to him. He didn't agree with me, so we ended up separating. And so we ended up having to do a search for a new chief, and mm-hmm. we didn't stand up a department from scratch, because technically we never really abandoned. We just transferred the management of the Chatham County Police Department to the city of Savannah, and we still own the equipment,
right,
be it weapons, cars, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So when it came to standing it up, it was really just deciding what you want the department look like, and what kind of, and really coming up with a profile for a chief. And we really wanted to do a nationwide search to bring on a chief who had a different thought of policing and really embrace what everybody says they want to do is community policing, but everybody don't embrace it. It's just a word they throw out.
Sounds good.
Yeah. But we wanted somebody who really embraced it. And so we thought that we would have an opportunity to do sort of a model department, and so far it has not disappointed. I think that we did some initial personnel decisions was panned out. We haven't followed up on some of the others in replacing all the top brass at the police department, but I think that we're on the right road. And I just think that at some point, if you really wanted to have an efficient government, you ought to get it down to maybe 3 to 4 municipalities max. I don't know if you'll ever be able to consolidate like they have in Muskogee or even Bibb or Richmond. If you think about it, in Bibb County, there were only 2 municipalities. So you still have a small municipalities, and everything else is Bibb County Macon or Macon Bibb County. Mm-hmm. And that seems to work well, but they've had a lot of issues and problems over there with their budget and everything else that haven't manifested itself so far in Savannah. But I think that you could easily have the city of Savannah, the city of Pooler, perhaps Tybee. It's a question whether or not you would have Thunderbolt, but perhaps Thunderbolt and everybody else ought to be absorbed into the city of Savannah or Pooler, in my opinion. Now, that won't be popular, but that includes Garden City, Bloomingdale, Port Wentworth. The reason for being chartered in the first place no longer exists.
The incorporation movement has died, but it certainly took a big hit last year when it failed out at Skidaway. Does that, from your perspective, does that kind of nip that in the bud for now? Do people look for consolidation more, or you think it'll come back?
I think so, but what was driving it was consolidation, mm-hmm. because
the threat of it, yeah.
People at Skidaway didn't want to be in the city of Savannah. The people on Wilmington Island don't want to be in the city of Savannah. Mm-hmm. So that in itself was a driver. Mm-hmm. But you really have to get the group together if everybody's willing to put the cards on the table, and if you can really demonstrate that you can save money and cut taxes, I think people may be more motivated. But for instance, Skidaway, I lived out there for 15 years. I happen to know it pretty well. If you're paying an association fee, and then you're going to pay property taxes in excess of what you're currently paying, which is a little less than 5 mils in the unincorporated area, and you're only paying for police services, dry trash, EMS, that type of service is all you're paying for. And where people get confused when we start talking about M&O, when you're paying that mill where it's collected, I don't care what municipalities
right.
you're in,
right.
that is to fund the constitutional office. That is to fund the court system. That's to fund the DA.
Countywide services, yeah.
Tax commissioners. And that's where people get confused. It's a... well, I'm paying twice for police service. No, you're not. Mm. But and that's the part that is tough to get people to understand.
Yeah. It would take a heck of a marketing effort, as
absolutely.
I think most of us have recognized in the last couple of years. So,
but everybody wants to protect their own turf, and I guess that's the reason you have turf, so you can protect it.
There you go.
Yeah.
Before I let you go, what's next? Are you is your public service career...
Well, I told someone, I said, you know, last time I was in elected office, I stayed out for 18 years. And so if I stay out for 18 years this time, I might be too old to run.
Yeah.
But the only thing that I haven't done in my life that I used to daydream about, and that's going to Congress. And I don't know if I could bring myself to run for Congress and make that trek to Washington every week.
Yeah, and that's a whole nother ball game,
yeah.
To say the least.
Yeah.
To say the least. Well, if we see a year and a couple of months away standing up a campaign, then we won't be surprised. But thanks so much for coming in. Thanks for your service to this community. I can't even find the right words.
I really thank the community for allowing me to serve in various capacities for so long. And some people can consider it quite a feat, and some people consider it not very much. But coming from the lanes and slums, and having served as a statewide constitutional officer, and having people teasing you that you might be the next governor and all that, I would say that I've had really a very good stay in public life. I've avoided controversy or anything too embarrassing. I can remember a governor telling me, he says, just keep two things in mind. He says, don't do anything to embarrass yourself or your grandmother. And I've tried to live by that motto. So during my time in public office, I've tried not to do anything to embarrass myself or my grandmother.
Yeah. Well, very good. And it sounds like maybe there might be another office for you in 2022, right? Be the first African-American governor.
I don't think so. I think the politics statewide is so different.
Right.
I can remember when we had a statewide primary, we had Andy Young, Roy Barnes, Norman Underwood, all those guys, and Zell Miller all running for governor, and Zell Miller came out ahead, and I was supporting Zell Miller, and it took Andy Young, I don't know, almost a decade to get over it.
To forgive you? Yeah, I can imagine.
So, but he did. But politics is so different now. I think people are locked in as to who is going to run in the next primary. So I think the nomination, barring some unforeseen event, might be a foregone conclusion. But who will get elected in a general election is not foregone. But I'm just talking about the party nominees.
That's right. That's right. Well, very good. Thank you again for coming in, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Same here.
That's all for this episode of Difference Makers. Thanks to Chatham Commission Chairman Al Scott and to our presenting sponsor, the Savannah Economic Development Authority. Tap into the Difference Makers archives anytime on your favorite podcast app to hear interviews with more of Savannah's community leaders, such as Make-A-Wish George's Megan Lowe, Plant Riverside District Developer Richard Kessler, and Deep Center Executive Director Dare Dukes. Difference Makers is a production of the Savannah Morning News and SavannahNow.com. On behalf of myself and producers Asha Gilbert and Zach Dennis, thank you for listening.